We should get to work. Okay, good morning, everyone. Welcome to the fifth work session, fifth of five work sessions to be followed by number of hearings to be named later, but we think we've got a schedule of hearings set up. Appreciate everybody's engagement in this. Today we get to map issues, with no more introduction than that, I'll turn it over to Susan.
Good morning. Thank you all for being here again. This is, as the mayor said, our fifth and final, hopefully, work session for now on the comprehensive plan, and I appreciate your diligence. And today we're going to focus on the land use map, primarily. With me here today are two people you already know well, Deborah Stein and Eric Engstrom, our principal planners, and along with Teresa St. Martin and Catherine Schultz from the Planning and Sustainability Commission, because they wanted to be able to tell you how they worked through all of these issues. So today we're going to talk about the map, and it puts forth all of the different comprehensive plan designations. Most of the designations are proposed to stay pretty much the same as they are today. But we are proposing some changes, and those changes are being proposed so that we can do a better job at reaching our broad goals on economic development, housing, transportation, land use, and other issues. I think just as we've talked about at the other work sessions, Portland, as you know, currently has enough residential capacity to support our future population growth. So that's not the issue that you need to deal with today. Instead, the question really is, do we have all of that capacity in the right places that we need it in order to meet our goals? So can we direct growth to the centers and corridors? Can we direct growth to the central city? And can we invest in enough infrastructure so that we can make wonderful walkable neighborhoods in East Portland and in other places throughout the city? I think I've mentioned in the other work sessions also that the Planning and Sustainability Commission had many long discussions about the goals and the policies and all of the issues, but very much about specific places on the map. Ultimately, what they would do is, you'll remember this document, Portland Plan, and in there, you went from hundreds of indicators and benchmarks down to 12 measures of success. And they really used this and came back to, as they were looking at areas on the map, they were asking, does the map, along with the plans and goals, actually help to provide more wonderful walkable neighborhoods? Does it help provide for equity? Does it help the changes that we're proposing help to make housing and transportation together more affordable? All of those kinds of things. And so I think it really became sort of, and they can tell you more about it, they really did go back to it and say, well, what's the bigger picture here? So next week, on November 19th, you'll have your first hearing on the comp plan. At that hearing and the ones that follow, you'll probably hear sort of two general sets of kinds of comments. One will be on the goals and the policies. Those are more of the things we've talked about in the other work sessions around the broad kind of basis for the plan. And then you'll have specific comments about specific places. And the map comments really are things where people can specifically see how those changes are going to affect them and their property and their business and their future, whether they're homeowners or renters. And so you will hear really those two kinds of sets of comments. And when they're talking about the map, those people will either be very pleased that you're making those changes, or as you've heard already from some people, they will be somewhat unhappy about those changes. So I guess the guidance, and then you can ask questions while we're talking along here of Kat or Teresa. They really, as they looked at each one of the proposed changes, kind of one by one, they kept two things in mind. And the first was this larger context of, are these things actually helping us get to the goals? Because sometimes it really is necessary to make map changes in order to help us reach these broader economic development goals or these broader environmental goals, and they're very necessary, if you know, steps along the path. And then second, when the commission considered individual properties or neighborhoods, they looked at similar places or situations. So they didn't look at one place or one property in isolation. And Deborah will explain a little bit more about that. But we really tried to have parity so that we weren't just picking out one little neighborhood and didn't compare it to a lot of other neighborhoods that are just like that, tried to look at how those things affected the whole city. So that's enough for now. I just wanted to recognize, while they're both here, that Deborah and Eric together, from the Portland Plan days through the comp plan, they've been the team that made this thing move through. And so, along with the Planning Commission, along with Joe, and the district planners, have made this move through. And we're getting near the end, and I think they're very happy.
Okay, good morning. So this work session is designed to give you kind of a guided tour of the map. We want to take you through each layer of the map and both highlight some of the key changes that are proposed in the map, and these are changes that the Planning and Sustainability Commission has endorsed. And we also want to signal for you where we anticipate you might be hearing some significant testimony after having listen to testimony through the Planning and Sustainability Commission and knowing you're already receiving testimony. So we thought we'd flag some of those issues for you today.
Maybe even before you do that, Susan, you touched on this. Are you going to walk us through this page?
I think it would be,
at some point. I just think it would be useful to do that, even before we get into the
I could do a brief.
Yeah, because I think there's a lot of material in this little summary here, and it's pretty eye-opening, I think.
So what we're referring to is page one in your packet, the performance measures, and this is a, yes, I just put it on my screen, so if there's a way to shift it over to the...
None of us amateurs know how to, maybe Amanda does, let's see. Whoa, I'll be impressed. It takes a village to operate this AV system, so...
This is out of classification.
Way out of classification. Yeah, I would... Did she do
excellent.
It? Hey! Wow. Don't quit your day job, but that was impressive.
Amanda Fritz, RN.
So this is a translation of the Portland Plan measures that Susan mentioned, and we recognize that there had to be some translation because not all the 12 measures are exactly land use related. And so we took the land use ones and found specific mappable elements to them, and that's what these different measures represent. So the first bunch is the household performance measures, things like access to parks, commuting numbers, frequent transit access, the complete neighborhood index, which was an index we developed in the Portland plan that is an amalgam of a variety of things that are about walkability and access to local commercial services, access to family wage jobs, which we talked about, I think, a couple work sessions ago. The red line on the bar is the Portland plan goal for 2035, and the black line on the left of that usually is the current number.
Right.
So, for example, the parks access is the first one, and what it shows in the black then is the projected performance increase that's modeled as a result of the mapping and the transportation and other infrastructure investments that are part of this plan. So some of it does rely on those investments, not just the mapping changes.
I was struck by this. You know, this plan does a lot, but it doesn't get us as far as we need to go.
We set some ambitious goals, and so what it points to is that some of the things we have to do are beyond land use and the comp plan, that there are other behavior change and work that we need to do on all these.
That's a really important part, is that we realized pretty quickly that a lot of this was financial investments that are perhaps outside of the TSP and other kinds of things, and that a lot of change happens not by regulation. Change happens because people change behavior, and there's a whole lot of other things that we can do to get there. So we think the goals are still appropriate, but that it's not going to just be through a change in the zoning code that's going to get us there.
But specifically on the park issue, we discussed in the last session about not allowing parks in industrially zoned land, over 2 acres, and was there any discussion at the Planning Commission about reaching this parks goal vis-a-vis specifically limiting being able to add parks in areas where there are still large pieces of open land?
The, I'll just say one thing. The main issue is, and then you guys get, is that most of those industrial areas are not near large populations. Not all of them, but the ones that we were most of, it didn't help move this number. It may have helped increase the number of acres of parks, but not the parks access.
Well, colleagues, as we get to looking at specific maps, there are some specific industrially zoned lands that we're interested in acquiring because they're close to residential areas. So I don't think we should give up on moving the needle a little further.
Susan, I'm interested in the assumptions that go into things like goals and how we measure success. I'm particularly interested this week, Mayor, because the community survey came out, and not an expert on statistics, but I added up the columns of very good, good, and neutral. It turned out about 84% of Portland thought we were on the right track. Mm-hmm. But the headlines were the city going in the wrong direction and half the city upset with our direction, because depending on your ideological view of the city, you could interpret neutral as either positive, neutral, or negative. And most people chose to include neutral as negative, rather than, say, complacent or satisfied or didn't have enough information or whatever. So being clear about how we get to our benchmarks is important, because others will misconstrue them for us. So what are the assumptions, Susan, at a very high level that go into a 2035 goal here? What are the sort of financial assumptions, government versus private sector, and other considerations in very rough terms that go into establishing a 2035 goal?
The goals were both looked at from where do you think we can get based on land use changes primarily, and how would that impact? So we did modeling, and Eric can go a little bit more into this, but we basically did modeling of different parts of the city with different growth scenarios, and then how would that affect transportation use? How would that then affect air quality? How would that affect access to jobs? What we didn't do was try to look, and then we set either the goal right there or we set it something more ambitious. So the complete neighborhoods goal is a good example where we want to have an 80% access sort of rate for all residents, realizing instead of being 100%, it's because we looked at topography, we looked at the ability to get access to transit. We did look at the ability to raise enough money to have infrastructure to all of the places that don't have infrastructure now. So we went from all of the sort of practical issues that we could measure first. And so the goal doesn't necessarily reflect just what we think we can get to. That's why there are some gaps. It also has a bit of, and we did this during the Portland plan development, a bit of hopefulness that we can get somewhere further beyond these usual ways that we get places.
I would say that most of these high-level goals came from other plans you've adopted previously, like Parks 2020 or the Climate Action Plan, and were rolled up into the Portland plan to represent those plans. So we worked from those existing established bureau or system-specific plans and then worked backwards to what that goal needs to be.
Since Kirk Krieger's here, I'm reminded that there are some pretty ambitious goals for production of housing under our plan. And we've asked the Bureau to give us a clear sense of what it would take to accomplish those goals. And so he's going to tell us it would take this much direct subsidy, this much incentive, this much private market activity, this much prayer to get to that number. And that, for me, is enormously helpful as a policymaker, because then I'm reminded at budget time that we've made a commitment to give him those tools, or we've made a commitment to expand our toolkit to give him new tools. And I look forward as we move forward on this to getting the same kind of specificity about what it might take to accomplish that goal.
The closest thing to that that is in writing is the citywide system plan that we touched on briefly in the first work session, where there are specific investment packages that are tied to some of these measures. And so we can report back again on that.
So, yeah, again, I think just as we look at the maps, thinking about things like VMT and complete neighborhoods, transit access, those things pretty important that we do at least as much as we're proposing to do in this map.
Yeah, and I think it's when we first did this graph, we all got really depressed in the office because we weren't getting as far as we had set our goals. And then when I showed it to other planning directors around the country, because I was at a meeting with several of them, they were stunned that in 20 years you're going to shift by 26% the number of people out of single occupancy vehicles using land use and transportation tools. And so, you know, we shouldn't discount that there is some huge shifts here just through land use, which most cities don't think about.
So why isn't there a goal for the middle section?
The middle section are primarily areas where there were track and monitor performance measures set in the Portland plan rather than a specific goal. And that, again, that's taken from the plans we got them from. Some of the measures like watershed health are complicated indexes, and we don't have a way to really set where we should be on that. But we know which direction we want to go.
Yeah, I'm surprised we don't have a goal for tree canopy.
We can follow up on.
Okay, so as I said, we're going to give you sort of a guided tour of the map. We're not going to talk about everything. We're going to talk about themes and some of the things that we want to flag for your attention in particular. In your packet, you have tabs with each of the maps that I'll be talking about. And so Eric will be going over the first two maps, which are centers and corridors and jobs. He'll talk about those, and I'll talk about some of the residential changes, and those are in maps 4 and 5, but we'll get to those in a minute. I wanted to start with more of an overview just to talk about what is a comprehensive plan map. Most people are familiar with zoning, but this is the comprehensive plan map, and I want to talk about that for just a minute. In its simplest form, this is a map that expresses our policies into land use, how we translate our policies, our goals and directions into a land use plan. And it provides a long-term vision of how and where growth will be directed over the next 20 years. The comp plan map then guides zoning. And zoning, again, is what most people are familiar with. Zoning tells you what you can build today. In most cases, the comprehensive plan map and the zoning match, but in some very specific and deliberate situations, they may be different. And you'll be hearing more about that when we talk about the zoning map as one of the implementation projects to follow the comprehensive plan map, and it's closely tied. But today we're going to be talking about that longer-term vision. The urban design framework, you heard about it in the first work session, we'll just touch on it again, and that's more of the big picture illustration of what the form of our land use will be, what's the form of growth and development and location. And so the urban design framework guides the comprehensive plan, and the comprehensive plan map in turn guides zoning. I want to talk a little bit about what led up to the development of this plan. This map doesn't come out of nowhere. There is a several-year a foundation of public involvement that leads us to the map that's before you today. And it starts with the Portland Plan. I think that the three integrated strategies of the Portland Plan, the thriving educated youth, economic prosperity and affordability, and healthy connected city, each really tell us how place matters in the achievement of those goals. And so each of those strategies laid a foundation for kind of the placemaking function of the comprehensive plan map. And those strategies provide us direction about how and where growth should be directed to create vibrant places where all generations can thrive. And then the Portland Plan was followed by some more map-specific information gathering that the district liaisons and other planners have done with community members to consult with stakeholders, and that includes neighborhood representatives, some of our underrepresented communities. We've made some special attempts to reach people who haven't traditionally been involved in land use planning to gather information over the years 2012, 2013. And then in 2013, staff specifically conducted some what we call district mapping conversations. And these were very interactive sessions. We did 10 of those in different parts of the city to start putting colors on a map, post-its, really gathering information, looking at maps in a place-specific way. And then since then, staff has continued to have map and policy related dialogue with community stakeholders, and again, both the traditional neighborhood association, district coalitions, business districts, but also with our underrepresented communities, and that includes the diversity and civic leadership partners, tenants, youth, some of the audiences where we haven't typically been involved, haven't been involved in land use planning. We've tried to bring them to the table as well. And then, of course, our most successful engagement tool throughout all of our mapping efforts has been our map app. I think you've all probably played a little bit with the map app. It's our interactive tool. And it's a useful tool not only to display and explain information, but it's interactive, and we've allowed people to, from the comfort of their living room, provide us with comments and testimony directly into the map app. And what's also significant is that it allows for community members to have sort of a digital conversation because people can see other people's comments. So it's allowed for some dialogue through this interactive tool that people can see other people's perspectives about specific map-related issues. We've had phenomenal success with this map app. There was an article in the DJC yesterday. Some of you may have seen it. But we've had, since the map app's inception, we've had over 100,000 views, 4,000 individual comments, which is phenomenal. And I think about 20 to 30,000 people have used this tool. So very successful community engagement tool that we are excited about and hope to continue using for this kind of work. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Eric to talk about two of the map layers. And again, when I refer to map layers, I'm using the same structure that the map app includes. So we have one map that's tab one in your folder, and this is the composite map that shows all the changes together. And then we peel apart those changes into four layers. So again, centers and corridors is the first layer. Eric will talk about that. The second layer is jobs, and that includes employment, industrial, and campus institution changes. And then the next two have to do with residential changes, and I'll talk about those after Eric.
Thank you, Deborah. One more thing about the map app that's significant is that it is designed to work on your mobile phone, and that's very intentional. Many apps you have to sort of squint and see on the phone, but this is designed to scale to the phone. And what that does is it brings a more diverse demographic to who's viewing the app. There's actually more diversity in the comments we get from the map app than in our public meetings or our public hearings in terms of age, diversity, and income and other demographics. So that's very intentional. Deborah mentioned we're going to talk about each of the four map layers, and I'll start with the first two. Again, these bins of discussion were intentional to link back to the Portland plan, that we didn't just say, come one, come them all, give us your miscellaneous map changes. We set out to make these four distinct types of changes with the comprehensive plan, and so that may help you in terms of filtering and categorizing the kinds of testimony you have. And I'm going to talk about the first two, the centers and corridors overhaul of the comp plan map, which is, I believe, the tab two, the yellow dot. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about the employment one, which is tab four. Three. You did talk quite a bit about that at your economic session, so that'll just be a refresher. So the centers and corridors mapping changes have a thread back to the Portland plan and the Healthy Connected Communities strategy in that plan. The complete neighborhood strategy to get to a place that by 2035, 80% of people can walk to full services within their neighborhood. This is all based, as Deborah said, on the urban design framework, which is on page five of your packet, and there's some more detailed information that I'm not going to go through on the subsequent pages. That framework said about a typology of place type that came out of public discussion in the Portland plan and then was further vetted through the outreach that Deborah described. It describes different types of centers, town centers being the bigger kind of places where there's a higher level of expected growth, and neighborhood centers, which are smaller villages offering services for a smaller grouping of neighborhoods. You'll recall that in our first session, we mentioned that about 50% of the anticipated growth over the next 20 years is going to occur outside the central city in these centers and corridors. That's the proposed and recommended land use plan. These centers are intended as a mechanism to achieve that 80% of Portlanders living in complete communities, as I mentioned. And so we're striving to have 80% of households be within a 10-minute walk of one of these centers, whether it be a town center or a neighborhood center. Not 100% because there are some parts of town where that level of additional growth wouldn't be appropriate for various environmental or other objectives we have. We set and I want to just talk about where we derived this from. On page 2 of your packet is a graphic from the Portland plan, which was what we called at the time our 20-minute analysis areas, which are really the areas or the catchments that are around our existing commercial business districts.
Could you explain the colors, please? I can't read the...
The three different colors, or the four different colors, are just representing the different regions of the city. The western Portland groupings of areas are in green. The central city is in pink, and the east Portland is in yellow. That's just to help people oriented. The inner neighborhoods are the orange, right? The numbers just are keyed into the name of the district. There was a key with the original version of this. The point I want to make with this, though, is that on the subsequent pages, there are two example maps that zoom into two of those circles, and it shows how we arrived at that through an inventory of commercial business activity and drawing walk sheds around those business activity and those business hubs. And so it was a fairly methodical process, subject, again, to public vetting of where are our existing clusters of activity and how does that relate to the geography of the city. And so that's the origin of how we started drawing circles and dots on the map. It wasn't a random pattern. It was based on the presence and location of our existing business districts. From there, we set, to get to that 80%, we did some math and set a target of having about 3,500 households living in a neighborhood center and 7,500 households living around a town center. And that's based on how many people it takes to support different sizes of grocery stores and full-service commercial districts. So it's based on the notion of we want our business districts to be supportable by the people that can walk there from the surrounding neighborhoods. And so when you have a business district that has less population around it, it's dependent on auto traffic to sustain its commercial activity.
3,500 center, how many for town center?
7,500, and that's just different levels. The 3,500 is kind of what it takes to get a basic range of services in a commercial district. The 7,500 is more of a full range and a full service, larger grocery store kind of situation.
So would now be the right time to ask about the West Portland Town Center?
Sure.
Because I don't see very much upzone. I don't see hardly any upzoning around there, and I doubt that we're at 7,500 for the West Portland Town Center.
Each of these centers are at a variety of, they're not all exactly at those numbers, we did not change the land use in all of the centers. This is sort of setting the basic policy for what our future land use work will be, so there, we do envision a set of follow-up planning activities in the future that is looking at specific centers and making adjustments to better achieve those goals. And with the West Portland Town Center in particular, I think that's probably going to need to happen in conjunction as the Southwest Corridor project moves forward and we have more certainty on that. We will want to look at that town center again. We could look up the number of what its estimated current zoned capacity is and get that to you.
Yeah, I'm glad to see the neighborhood commercial from Pomona down to the Holly Farm Park, but there seems to be there's a huge missed opportunity, in my opinion. South of Barber, south of I-5, where there's currently some R2 fairly low density residential and that could easily accommodate a higher density mixed use zoning.
We'll follow up with you
Thank
on
you.
That.
I think, and both the bureaus, both bureaus and I, and Commissioner Novick as well, we need to make sure we fully anticipate the opportunity of both the Division Powell corridor and the Barber corridor in this plan.
Right, and Barber right now has rapid transit. I mean, the 94 bus goes directly from Tiger to the Barber Transit Center to downtown with like two stops. So we should be taking advantage of the current high-frequency, high-efficiency bus even while we're waiting for light rail. And maybe if we did that, we'd get better service down to up to PCC as well, because there'd be more people wanting to get to Barber Transit Center and then to PCC up there.
Thanks. These different place types then form the basis of the mixed-use land use designations that you see. So there is a land use designation for neighborhood mixed use and a land use designation for what we call urban center. And those directly correspond, the urban center corresponds to town centers and the closest in areas within walking distance of the central city. The neighborhood ones correspond to the neighborhood corridors and centers. And then there's another dispersed designation which corresponds to small nodes of mixed use that are located away from those centers and corridors that still serve a neighborhood purpose.
Well, let me just illustrate that point for a second, and then your question might make sense more or less after this, but let me stick with it. It's important to remember that this map, if I understand it correctly, represents both where we are increasing the density and intensity of development and where we're decreasing it, right? Or in some cases where we're simply relabeling it, right? So a lot of the zoning on these neighborhood, on these corridors now is storefront commercial or neighborhood commercial. And you have picked in each case a mixed use zoning designation from our new toolkit and applied it to that. In some cases that means there's going to be more buildable FAR on that site. In some cases there's going to be less, and certainly in the areas where you proposed going from R5 to R7, there's going to be less. So this map could be perceived incorrectly as the upzoning map.
No, I was just reflecting on something you said earlier about, you know, encouraging walking and how we build our town centers. Let me just offer a conundrum. So I live adjacent to the Hollywood district. So if I get off, if the number 12 bus drops me off in the heart of the district, or I get off at the MAX, I can do everything I need to do as a pedestrian and go to a grocery store, a drugstore, fix my shoes, and then walk home. And I can pick up Charlie's prescription. I can see a movie. I can go to a nice restaurant. I can pick up pizza. So I can do all that, and I sort of figured out. Particularly these days, since I'm a little more self-sufficient, how I can do all of that without my car. And yet, just down the street on Broadway, we've welcomed a new Seasons just below 33rd. There's no MAX there. It is a failed intersection. In fairness, PBOT said it was going to fail, and it has failed. Well, they said that you can't jam any more cars into it, and you can't. So it is now a failed intersection. And at the New Seasons, I'm not picking on New Seasons because just to the west of them is probably the largest outdoor parking lot in Northeast, which is the Fred Meyer. But the entire structure of New Seasons is built around multi-level parking. And it's very difficult to get there as a pedestrian because that 33rd intersection is actually not one that you'd want to cross, particularly if you had a young person with you. So we've been successful in Hollywood creating this walkable community, and yet we're creating all this activity on Broadway to the west that is designed to be accessible by cars. Are we working across purposes? And that whole development at 33rd is not MAX, is not connected to the MAX, even though it's on the MAX line. So is that an example of a win to the east and sort of a question mark at 33rd?
I would say that site is on frequent service bus lines, so it is still designed to be transit supportive. And I take your point about the, I think there's some devil in the details issues there around the sidewalk and the design of streets. And one of our, one of the discussions we had about in transportation was some of the limitations on why we make those decisions right now have to do with our engineering standards for how we handle traffic, and it is a failed intersection. We could have responded to that by dealing with more comfortable sidewalks, understanding that it would continue to fail. What we did was engineer a turn lane to make it fail less, and we prioritized the turning movement of the cars over the pedestrian experience there, and so that may relate to sort of the struggle we have with transportation policy and engineering.
Well, I see almost nobody shopping at New Seasons who walks. And you can't get a spot in the garage, so it's jammed. And in terms of how dangerous that intersection is, I once was standing in front of that fire, the business that sells fireplace equipment. I was standing on that intersection. It's a very narrow intersection, and it's not particularly safe. And a truck was coming from south to north and was making a turn. And as I stood there, the truck made the turn, went up on the sidewalk, and the top of the cab of the truck smashed into the sign for the store, which came down on top of me, shattered everything. And it was like, well, that's unpleasant. And the turning radius there is a challenge for trucks too. So it's just interesting that Hollywood, it is becoming what you've envisioned, a walkable community. But to the west, not so, at least until you get to 24th or so.
Unless you happen to live in the building that's right above New Seasons, and that's part of the design too. So I think it's.
I want to highlight a few other things about the centers and corridors. The civic corridors designation is an intentional concept. These are Portland's larger streets like Barber, Sandy, Foster, 122nd. They often divide neighborhoods today. They're often former or current state highways. This new designation is intended to communicate the aspiration to change these streets to make them actual places or great streets. And that is a land use designation that's about the land use, but it's designed to support transformation of those larger streets. And so that map is an important one to look at. The planned density on civic corridors is a little bit bigger than some of those narrower streets in keeping with the scale of the streets. We also mentioned in the last session that I think Commissioner Smith brought up this concept of the inner ring neighborhoods. And the land use map intentionally designates those neighborhoods that are in the closest within walking distance of the central city as urban center on this map, which is the same thing we're giving town centers. And that's intentional to recognize the role of those closest in neighborhoods in the sustainability of the city and shifting away from reliance on single occupancy vehicles. Households living in this geography are more likely to use transit, bike, or walk, and they have lower carbon footprints overall. So we are intentionally trying to create as much capacity for growth within that closest in area as possible. That's part of the resilience strategy of if all other systems fail, those folks can still walk to work within the central city geography. Finally, I also want to mention that the mixed-use map legalizes over 200 non-conforming small commercial uses throughout the city, and this is something you hear often through land use actions over time, that there are a lot of these small nodes of commercial activity that, for whatever reason in the past, were zoned as residential. And we are correcting a lot of those to recognize that those small isolated commercial storefronts in residential neighborhoods are here to stay, and they serve a legitimate purpose of enhancing walkability and neighborhood character.
That's an example.
If you're familiar, for example, maybe with the coffee shop at Ladd Circle, or there's a few little isolated spots on Clinton Street, or they're all over the city, really.
And I just want to mention, non-conforming commercial uses was one of the topics that engendered the most conversation at the Planning and Sustainability Commission, because some of these really are a little tricky. They are uses that are surrounded by, in many cases, residential. And so there's some concerns that even when there's a commercial use that is beloved for the use that it currently is, but we also have to think about once it is redesignated for commercial, it could be redeveloped into a different commercial or mixed-use use. So there was a lot of discussion, and I'm anticipating you will hear testimony about individual nonconforming uses where there may be either support or community opposition to a change from a residential zone, even if it's been in commercial use for a long time.
And there's sort of a difference in philosophy among different folks about whether being nonconforming is protective of a historic building or harmful to its continued health, and there are definitely some different perspectives on that.
So looking at this map and looking at the corners, Linton and Argay and Wilkes in the northeast, Centennial and Pleasant Valley in the south, in the southeast, Arnold Creek and Collins View on the land use corridors and centers, and then Linton as I go around the circle here. There's not much intensification there. There's not any opportunity
Correct.
Still for any commercial in Arnold Creek, for example, and hardly any, and not showing much intensity, more intensity at Terwilliger and Taylor's Ferry. So what was the discussion about the outer neighborhoods at the Planning Commission? Because we're not, those are the neighborhoods which are the least 20-minute neighborhoods that we've got, and yet we're not showing any proposed changes there.
I'm not sure I have a specific answer for you, except I think it was a focus on kind of land use patterns today, and trying to get then that tied with transportation opportunities. And then there was a lot of focus and discussion, I would say, honestly, mostly on East Portland and how do we really support that and create that opportunity there. I don't know if I can, I mean, not to say there wasn't discussion about maybe Barber and stuff like that where you're already seeing it, but not so much in depth in the, let's say, white areas. That being said, part of the reason maybe I don't remember it specifically is you guys doing such a good job to say there's challenges in these certain areas, and maybe you could help refresh my memory, Deborah. But so, you know, we did have discussions, let's say, about the hills and the challenge with resiliency on the hills and land sites, and do you really want to be focusing development in areas where perhaps we need to rethink how we're developing there, or should we be developing there?
From the staff point of view, many of those corners, as you said, are fairly low density residential, and they're that way in part because of environmental constraints. And when we run the numbers, we can't get enough density there to support a commercial district without some pretty major changes. And so we chose to prioritize the environmental protection there rather than going the route of the complete communities in those corners. I mean, that was a staff choice. We could have gone a different direction. So, you know, you're welcome to weigh in on that element.
Well, and also because they're primarily residential, they didn't have any kind of core to start with in terms of having services. And so we basically said with lack of infrastructure, we were going to stick in these areas where we could do something.
It just seems like they're in 2035, they're going to be exactly the same as today with no transit, no services, nothing you can walk to, no sidewalks to walk on. And so even though we can't get to a complete neighborhood, it seems like we should be doing something to promote a little bit of change in those corner neighborhoods.
So that's one of the things we could do, the what if kind of games with you. If you have particular areas, whether it's, you know, up further from St. John's or further north, that you would like us to look at, what would it take to be able to? Because what happens is that we could upzone a little bit and add a little bit of commercial that might make the neighbors happy right there. It's not going to actually ever get TriMet to still have, because there's not going to be enough unless you made big change. And then that could be something that you propose, and we can model what it would look like and how to get there. But we don't know that. The other thing we looked at was market reasonableness. Would, you know, if you zone it, will they come? And will people, the private sector builds all this. We're just kind of laying out the rules, and the public sector has, you know, very little money in the game in the big picture. So in many of these places, we also said we don't think there's a market in those places to attract private dollars. But we know we didn't get it right everywhere. So I'm happy if You want us to play with a couple of these places?
Yeah.
We can meet. Yes, she's shuddering.
Very impressed that I haven't had this storm of protest as the maps came out that we suffered in 95 when I was on the Planning Commission. And there's still some opportunity areas. For example, the Arno Creek Neighborhood Association has no multifamily zoning in its neighborhood.
Yeah.
That would be a baby step to maybe zone for apartments near Stevenson School, for example. I'm sure you haven't had much input encouraging you to do that, but it's something that if we looked at and started looking at the benefits, those kinds of areas.
It always turns into the chicken and egg conversation about needing a certain number of rooftops or, you know, certain population density to support the market for certain kinds of shops and that, and the level of transit we want. And so we, always have to weigh that with, is that supportable? And it engenders a lively conversation when we get into areas that are currently very low density.
Yeah, it just doesn't seem right to just leave them and say, well, that's going to be like that forever.
Another factor in that conversation was that if we are going to designate a center, we want to be able to support it with infrastructure. And we ran into some significant cost challenges in supporting the infrastructure in some of the steeper, hillier parts of the city in the corners.
These areas I'm talking about are not steeper or hillier.
So that might be a case of, finding the right spot. So I'm going to transition now to the second topic, and again, this is a quick refresher. Employment map changes were primarily, as we talked about a few weeks ago, driven by the need to create enough capacity for employment growth over the next 20 years, and we've had some, unlike the residential numbers, we are constrained in the amount of employment land we have relative to the forecast growth. And so there are some changes designed to deal with that, really in a couple categories. The first category was colleges and hospitals, 15 colleges and hospitals campuses that we redesignated on the land use map as campus institutional. The intent there is to recognize that these institutions are permanent parts of the landscape and increasingly important to the city's economy. The PSC recommended, accordingly, moving beyond the current conditional use regulatory approach, and we have more specific proposals to implement that now going through the Planning and Sustainability Commission soon at the code level. But the land use map just establishes the basic policy intent to be followed up with zoning changes. The second category is in the Harbor and Columbia Corridor. The commission recommended new industrial sanctuary designation on a few sites in the Columbia Corridor that add up to approximately 125 acres of net addition to the land supply. Finally, the third category was other smaller scale neighborhood employment, primarily in East Portland. This included in places like 82nd Avenue, Gateway, Outer Sandy, Hayden Meadows in North Portland. This was to increase a range of office and light manufacturing opportunities throughout the city. That added up to about 148 acres of additional employment capacity in total. And this map, again, is the green tab with the blue colors on the actual map, number 3. So that was a quick reminder of that. I think at this point we had scheduled a discussion period for further Q&A on what I've just said.
Well, I guess I have the map with the blue. Once upon a time, there were some discussions about creating along the I-5 corridor kind of a sports and entertainment district. And, at some point in the past, someone proposed putting a baseball stadium somewhere further out towards Washington and capitalizing on some of the city-owned land along there. You look at this map, I-5 is not critically, as a spine, it's not critically important, except in two places, to future job growth. And I wonder why that is. When you have a highway like that running through the city, why isn't that more dynamically linked to job and particularly around sports and entertainment opportunities along that spine?
The quick answer, and then Eric will go in, is this doesn't show all the job growth areas. This shows the changes that we're making to additional, in particular, employment lands. So that's not all of our commercial jobs. It's not all of our other kind of employment.
Yeah, I think that's right. There is quite a bit of employment land in the I-5 corridor, and much of it is already in there, so we're not changing it. I would say that the North I-5 corridor is significantly challenged from a transportation congestion point of view, so our ability to continue upzoning there is pretty severely limited at this point until we can deal with that question.
I think you'll hear this more as the institutional zoning project moves through the Planning Commission in the next month or two and then comes to y'all, is that we've seen such a huge amount of growth in hospitals and universities in the city in terms of actual jobs, and it is, you know, our big growth center, and we want to make sure that we are doing it in a way that makes it easier, but also has less impact on the neighbors that surround them.
So are we ready to move on to the residential and open space map changes? Okay, so the layer that I'm now going to talk about is map number 4, the blue tab, and we've called this layer risks and service gaps. And this represents two different types of proposed changes that I'm going to talk about. And the first group is where we have proposed residential changes that are related to public health and safety. And these are in areas where we're proposing to down-designate properties in order to reduce the amount of future development that we would allow in areas that have natural hazard risks. And these changes also are proposed to recognize infrastructure and connectivity constraints. And so generally, these are areas, and I can point to areas on this map that are in various parts of the Southwest Hills, on the hillside above Linton, which is in Northwest Portland, and then in East Portland, right around Powell Butte. And there's also one additional area, a small pocket above, on a bluff above Oaks Bottom. And what all these areas have in common are that they contain steep slopes, poorly draining soils, limited stormwater pipe systems, poor street connectivity, few sidewalks. And these are areas that are prone to landslides, wildfire, earthquake damage, and or flooding. These areas also have in common that they're generally not near or existing or planned centers. And they're costly. If we were to upgrade service levels, it's particularly costly to do so in these areas because of terrain and other constraints. And all these areas that we looked at are areas where currently the comprehensive plan designations and the zoning would allow a fairly significant amount of additional residential development. So we looked at these with the intent to avoid exacerbating any existing problems that exist, and we want to reduce future risks and future costs and future impacts both to public health and safety and to property. Now, this proposal that I'll be talking about, it doesn't stop development in these areas, but it just reduces the number of new additional units that can be built. We had a lot of support for this set of proposals, starting with, decades of concerns expressed by the public, but we also had a watershed health and environmental policy expert group that was one of our advisory groups in the early stages of the comprehensive plan, and they provided us strong support for taking a fresh look at the potential impacts of growth in these areas where those natural hazards and drainage constraints exist. We also work closely with your bureaus to develop this proposal, environmental services, transportation, development services, the Water Bureau, emergency management, and fire and rescue. And in particular, fire and rescue brought to us information about emergency response times and how those are constrained in light of some of the narrow, windy streets and the terrain. So again, this was a proposal that we developed with a lot of consultation with bureaus, but also with neighborhood representatives and others who are affected in these areas of concern. There's quite a great deal of policy support for these changes. As I said, the policy expert group advised us on this, and we have policies in the plan that talk about supporting targeted investment in centers and corridors. So where we have limited infrastructure dollars, let's put them where we expect to see growth and where we want to be addressing infrastructure disparities that affect underserved and underrepresented communities. And this is instead of investing those dollars in areas where we don't anticipate a great deal of growth and where it's much more costly to upgrade service levels. This proposal implements policies to improve resilience to natural hazards and climate change, and again, to direct growth away from areas with natural hazards and infrastructure of constraints. The proposal, as I mentioned, allows a lesser amount of future development. And when we looked at our buildable lands inventory and looked at projecting growth, this approach is consistent with that in that we didn't foresee a lot of development in these areas, even though the current comprehensive plan and zoning would allow that. But we were looking at the physical constraints and infrastructure constraints, so we didn't assume full build-out here. And the proposal also helps us to retain our green infrastructure, our tree canopy, and other parts of the green infrastructure that we rely on, and they support innovative approaches to, for example, street-by-street, new designs for connectivity and so forth. So we feel like there's a great deal of policy support, and in your packet, if you want to see some of the excerpts of policies, I've included that handout number 7, which is just in front of the maps, and it lists some of the policies in the recommended plan that help provide guidance for this proposal. The Planning and Sustainability Commission received testimony from approximately 5% of the affected property owners in these areas. And of that 5%, it was about 50-50 in support and in opposition. But what this also means is that we didn't hear from 95% of the property owners affected by this proposal. So we felt that was fairly significant.
And presumably we had mailed notice
required. We did. As required by state law, we sent notices to every affected property owner.
And how many of them are down zoning rather than down designating?
For this set of proposals, we would propose to match the zone with the designation, so they would be both.
But currently, how many of them are currently zoned so that we would be down zoning versus designated, so we'd just be down designating?
They're all. Yeah, they're all.
So we're changing the actual zoning.
For the most part, it's from 10 to our 20. There are some R7 to R20 as well.
And later, I'd like some information from our city attorney about potential issues.
Yes. There have been a number of conversations, and I know they are here to respond.
So, along those lines, so can we focus on Foster, Holgate, say 122nd to about 140? Because that's the biggest area of activity is that area of the Outer East. And Foster with Foster Floodplain, Sanger, Leach, it's becoming kind of an eco district.
Mm-hmm.
But we have homeowners in that area that are already facing enormous challenges, floodplains, inability to get insurance because of that, watersheds, environmental contamination in some places. To what extent are you assuming that the city is going to use its resources to either acquire properties, compensate homeowners, or do something by way of mitigation in any part of the areas in Outer East?
Some of these areas, there are a variety of acquisition programs that the city has. We don't have a specific one related to this proposal. The some of these areas are also being down designated due to lack of infrastructure, sidewalks, things like that. So, and as was hinted before, there is a consultation with the city attorney because under state law, a down designation and down zoning in some circumstances, the property owner could ask for compensation, and we have a process to either consider that or waive the regulation in question, and so that would be something that would come up here potentially.
Although the state law also does talk about, in the interest of public health and safety, there is a provision to allow for down designation, and in these cases, if there's a significant risk that we can document, I think that's sound.
But let's take again the area around between Foster and Holgate, 120 to 140. Is there? I have to go back and look, but does this planning link up with